This is the Sean Hannity Show podcast.
And thanks, Scott Shannon. Glad you're with us. Sean Hannity Show. And joining us now is the author of the mega bestseller, More Guns, Less Crime, who is driving liberals nuts for years. And he now has his new next big bestseller on the market. It's At the Brink. John Lott Jr. is back with us. How are you, sir?
Oh, great to talk to you again, Sean.
Let me just start with the gun issue, and then we'll get into the broader issue. We see what happens at Newtown. You see the reaction of everybody to all of this. Over the weekend, did you see the video of the guy that was using the AR-15 to defend himself?
No, I missed that. Yeah. I was traveling.
And one of the things liberals don't like is logic, statistics, facts to back up their narrative or destroy their narrative. That's what you do in More Guns, Less Crime. What do you say with in light of all of this gun mania that's going on? We can only have 7 bullets in New York now legally.
Right. Well, you know, people talk, and the president and others talk about the benefits from their proposals. They never talk about the costs. And the problem is, despite what may be the best of intentions in many cases, a lot of these rules that they're going to put in place are going to cost people's lives. So you take something that seems to be the most popular proposal that the president has with regard to these so-called universal background checks. The president's made a lot of false statements with regard to supposedly 40% of gun sales don't go through background checks, or they've talked about 1.7 million prohibited people prevented from buying guns because of background checks. Both of those claims are false. But more importantly, you take something like the 1.7 million people. Almost all of those are false positives, and which means that you had a law-abiding citizen who tried to go and buy a gun but was stopped from doing so. It's kind of like you may remember the late Senator Ted Kennedy was on the no-fly list 5 times. Would we count that as 5 times we stopped a terrorist from flying? No, nobody would do that. What you care about is what ultimately happened. He got on a flight eventually. He was inconvenienced. And the same thing's true with almost all of those 1.7 million Americans with the guns. Now, for a lot of them, it may simply be an inconvenience. But for some of them who are being stalked or threatened, who need to get a gun quickly for self-defense, they're being stopped from doing that. And there's some real harm that results from that. And so if you want to change things, first of all, try to fix the system rather than trying to add in a lot more names and creating a lot more of these false positives and a lot more people who are going to be unintentionally but harmfully prevented from being able to protect themselves.
You know, I think that's one of the narratives that have been lost in all of this. For example, a lot of women, they get protection orders and they need to protect themselves and protect themselves quickly. Maybe a situation's unfolding. I don't know what happened in this case, the South African model with this Blade Runner guy, but obviously something went really wrong there. Who knows? Maybe she was threatened before. I don't know if she in that country would have the ability to get a gun.
Right. Well, I mean, protection orders are really only a very limited use. And it'd be great if the police were there all the time. My research shows that police are the single most important factor for stopping crime. But if you go and talk to the police, one thing they'll tell you very clearly is that they realize that themselves. They virtually always arrive on the crime scene after the crime's been committed. And street officers will very commonly recommend that people who are being threatened, they'll recommend them themselves that they go and get a gun for self-protection because they know they can't be there to protect them.
Well, I think that's one of the big narratives of the day. When you say more guns, less crime, and then I'll move on to this new book of yours, which is terrific. Explain exactly what that means for the person that knows nothing about guns. Because so the average person will say, well, they keep advancing this notion. Everybody just about that I've debated on guns says you're more likely to hurt yourself or a loved one with your gun if you have a gun in your house. That's not true.
No, it's not. Well, I mean, the new book, At the Brink, does go through the current debate on guns. But the point you just bring up, it's really sad that this keeps on getting repeated over and over again. Because I think it really endangers people's lives. It makes it so the people who really need guns for self-defense don't get it. And just to understand, it's basically a few public health studies that were done where they would go and look at people who died near a house over the course of a year, and then they'd ask the relatives of the deceased whether or not that person owned a gun. then they would just assume that if you died from a gunshot, it was that gun in the home that did the killing. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Of the 444 homicides that were studied in the first study, only 8 of those were due to the gun that was in the home. The other 436 were being improperly claimed as being due to the gun that was in the home. And if you just fix that one mistake, it completely reverses the claim.
Unbelievable. Let's talk about the looming Obama scare disaster, as you call it.
Will Obama
push us over the edge?
Right. Well, I mean, there are lots of things that we're really at the brink with regard to. You can look at, for example, just the current debate on the sequester that we have. Obama keeps on claiming that we have to go and spend more money to get the economy going. You would think at this point Americans would realize these huge, massive deficits, just in the first 2 years, he had a 21% real increase over and above inflation, increase in government spending. We've never had such a large increase in government spending in our nation's history. Even during World War II, you didn't have as large of an inflation-adjusted increase in government spending. And yet we've had a horrible economy. But it's not just us. You look around the world, the countries that had the biggest increases in deficits, the biggest increases in government spending, had the lowest growth rates. And so we're kind of ending up in the worst of all worlds. We're spending a lot of money, getting huge deficits. That means we're going to have to pay high taxes in the future, and our kids are going to be burdened with it. And it's producing lower growth at the same time.
It's basically negligible growth. Since he's been president, our growth is 0.8%. And the last quarter, we had a contraction, negative growth. You get 2 quarters of that, and you've got a recession.
Right. We've never had such a slow recovery.
By the way, if we have one, it'll be George Bush's fault. Some way, somehow, in the fifth year of the Obama presidency, it'll be George Bush's fault, or talk radio's fault, or Fox News's fault, or your fault.
Well, at least we'll know who to blame, I guess.
Well, I mean, I never met a president like this that's constantly blaming everybody else for his failed programs. But in one sense, it's a failed program, yes, but it's a success for him. And as much as he's getting his agenda through, or has gotten a lot of his agenda through, and that then becomes a big problem unto itself.
Well, yeah, you look at, we had these 5 different jobs programs that were passed during the first 2 years of his administration when the Democrats had these super majorities, and look to where the money went. It went to very heavily Democrat, very heavily union states. And it didn't go to the states that had the highest unemployment rates. The money didn't go to the poorest states. It didn't go to the places that had the highest bankruptcy or foreclosure rates. The big thing that predicts where the money went was the percentage of your congressional delegation that were Democrats. The more Democrats, the bigger share of Democrats in your congressional delegation, the more money you got through the stimulus program. And it was basically a long wish list, as you know, of things that they've had before. But the thing is, it damaged the economy. And the book goes through multiple ways, but just one way. When you move around more than $1 trillion+ from where you and I would have spent it to where the government wants it spent, not only do you move that money, but you move around the jobs that would have been associated with that money in different companies. And the problem is people don't instantly move from one job to another. It takes time. And that chaos, not just the spending chaos, but the mess of regulatory chaos and other things, this churning in the economy generates unemployment as you move people around from where they would have been to where the government wants them to be. And unfortunately, you're not only creating that loss and that reduced output while you're moving these individuals around, but you're also moving them into less productive areas. There's a reason why those jobs weren't there to begin with. There's a reason why those jobs are only there as long as you have those big subsidies. And that's essentially saying that we're moving them to areas where they're going to get lower pay and there's going to be less output overall for the country as a whole.
You have a whole chapter on more stimulus, fewer jobs, and lower wages. But if we look at the broader picture here, I mean, the level of failure, $6 trillion in debt that the president has given us and growing, $1 trillion deficits now as far as the eye can see, a president that refuses to deal with the underlying cause. They won't even recognize on the left that we have a spending problem, hence comments by Tom Harkin and Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi. But on every level, they have failed. 18 million more Americans on food stamps is a failure of the government to grow opportunity in this society. In other words, they've hurt the growth or potential right. growth of business. So if you look at the vitality of our economy, the taking over of healthcare and the costs now are, and the reality is beginning to hit home, immigration, energy policy, which I think is Obama's biggest failure. We're seeing the price of gas once again go through the roof, and personal liberty. This president has basically undermined every single what we consider to be historic American positions on these things.
Right. No, we're going to be a much less free, much poorer country. And I am greatly concerned that it's not going to be possible to reverse much of this damage that's been done.
It is damage. I mean, when you take on $6 trillion in debt and you create such dependency, that's damage.
Well, publicly held debt has doubled already under the Obama administration. This is, you know, when you're talking about $200,000 per family of four in the United States, that's a real amount of money that your family owes in the future. That means that there are other things that you're not going to be able to do. I mean, how do people really think that the amount of government services that they've gotten under the Obama administration, the increase in government services, is worth that much debt to their families? Would they rather have that money themselves that they could have spent on something else? It's hard to believe that almost anybody would think that that was the case, that they would have, that they feel they got a good deal out of that. But, you know, if you look at Obama's statements over time, in 2008, he ran promising to cut government spending. He promised a net reduction in government. He promised a smaller government. And then when we had the stimulus, which just arose a week or two after the election suddenly appearing, we were told that that was just going to be temporary, maybe a year, maybe 2 years increases. Now we're into the fifth year of the Obama administration, and we're told we can't cut it at all because if we cut even the growth rate, somehow that's going to hurt the economy and jobs that are there. And the exact opposite is true, that we need to go and let resources and let people go to places where they're best used rather than where Obama thinks that they're best used.
Well, I think that you captured it and summed it up pretty well in the book when you said he is emotionally committed to raising taxes on, quote, the rich. And you pointed out something that very few in the media probably know, is that he spent over a decade talking about this. I mean, this fairness. This is why I went back deep into right. black liberation theology, which is rooted in socialism redistribution, because that is fundamentally what he has always believed. That's why there's never... He gets a tax increase and he starts the next day asking for more taxes. You know, he wants to stop the sequestration and he wants to raise more taxes.
Right. Well, I knew Obama at Chicago, as you know. We both taught there at the University of Chicago Law School. We overlapped for about 4 years. And
yeah, you said you had one encounter with him, right?
Well, I had a couple dozen encounters, but the first encounter was about guns. But I've talked to him, or briefly at least, or was around him when he was talking about many issues. And, you know, he's a real true believer. I mean, in academia, I was used to being a conservative surrounded by lots of liberals around there. But you still respected other people because they were willing to talk to you about issues. Instead, the impression they always got from Barack was that he viewed people he disagreed with as evil, that he didn't even want to shake hands. He would turn his back on you and walk away. I had been around a lot of academics, a lot of liberal academics who I disagreed with, but he was unique and he stood out in that way. When we had the 2008 campaign and people were talking about, well, he's going to bring people together, I said, that doesn't really seem like the guy that I knew at the time. But the first conversation I'd had with him, I went up, I introduced myself. He said, oh, you're the gun guy. And I said, yeah, I guess so. And he turned to me and he said, I don't believe people should be able to own guns. And I'd heard he'd been helping with the city of Chicago suit against the gun makers, and he was working with the Joyce Foundation, which is the biggest funder of anti-gun activities in the country. But I said, look, you know, maybe we can get together for lunch sometime and talk about this. And our conversation ended. He kind of wrinkled his face, turned around his back to me and walked away, and that was the end of our first conversation. And that's the way a lot of our conversations would go.
So he just really had no time to even discuss or hear your point of view, or no open mind whatsoever. So he really doesn't want anybody to have guns, but like everything else, he has to hide his real views.
Right. Well, I think we're seeing more of it come out after the election here, after he no longer has to face the voters here.
Yeah. But the question is, can he be successful? I mean, that's going to be the real test. I mean, everything I've been reading today is that he wants to get Democrats elected to the House and Nancy Pelosi Speaker again. Do you think that's possible?
Well, I mean, you need to talk to a political type more than myself. I was just in Colorado giving some talks over the weekend, and Joe Biden, they have some major gun control laws that are going through the democratically controlled legislature there, and Biden have been calling up legislators, kind of twisting their arms to make sure that they voted for gun control, because the claim was that the president was then going to use victories in relatively pro-gun states like Colorado to use that to help push for gun control nationally.
All right. John Lott, brilliant academic. Thank you for being with us. And I know you get beaten up a lot in the press, but we appreciate your hard work more than you know. It's called At the Brink. Will Obama Push Us Over the Edge? And it's in bookstores now. John, thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for being there, Sean.
All right, 800-941-SEAN is our number. You want to be a part of the program. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll hit the phones next. Your call is coming up straight ahead.
Hannity Headlines. A bite-sized version of the show that you can take with you anywhere you go. To sign up today for Hannity Headlines, go to Hannity.com.
All right, when we come back, we'll hit the phones. You can join us toll-free, 800-941-SEAN, if you want to be a part of the program. Hannity tonight at 9. Troubles with the economy, but party time for the Obamas also. We've got wild skits on SNL. Did they cross a line in attacking Christians? We've got the Benghazi definitive report and Alec Baldwin unglued. We'll have the details of Alec Baldwin's latest meltdown. 9 Eastern, Hannity on the Fox News Channel.
We know you never want to miss the Sean Hannity Show. And now you never have to. Just sign up for Hannity Headlines. A bite-sized version of the show that you can take with you on your laptop, your mobile phone, everywhere you go. Even to your liberal in-laws' place in Vermont.
So, yeah.
And after a few hours of that, you'll be glad you brought Sean along. To sign up today for Hannity Headlines, go to Hannity.com.
All right, rolling along. Sean Hannity Show on Obama Day. It's President's Day, so it's really his day, and that hence he gets his big, extravagant, lavish vacation, $1,000 an hour, because everybody's got to sacrifice. Everybody's got to pay. And then playing golf with Tiger Woods. Of course, Michelle, vacationing in a different locale. Don't worry about the cost to the taxpayers here. That's what, you know, we can eat cake. Well, it's kind of true. I never went golfing with Tiger Woods. I never paid $1,000 for a golf lesson. Kind of a lot of money, isn't it, for a golf lesson? $1,000 for an hour? I mean, I hope it was worth it. I hope the president's game got better. I would have foregone that and just said, Tiger, teach me how to hit the ball. Ask the best person in the world. Whack. Four! That's if I'm playing. All right, let's get to our busy telephones here. Let's say hi to Pam is in Ohio. What's up, Pam? I am. How are you?
Hi, Sean. How are you?
What's going on?
I have a question. At what point do you think it's appropriate to hold corporations accountable for some of the problems with the economy?
What do you mean, corporations?
For example, like Walmart, I know it gets demonized a lot, but the discrepancy between the CEO pay and the normal pay, and the fact that the majority of their workers don't even make enough, they need public assistance.
I don't know that. I've never heard that they need. Well, first of all, Walmart is the largest employer in the entire country. Did you know that? They provide more jobs, more opportunities for a lot of people. If you work at Walmart, by the way, and you're a trainee in North Dakota, you get $17 an hour. But they also give benefits, as I understand it, to full-time workers. And it's a good company to work for. Now, you got to ask yourself a question. Should Walmart be creating, I mean, they're known for providing a whole bunch of products at low prices that people want, need, and desire, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if you want to work at Walmart, I would assume that your goal is not to get rich, but you just want to make a little money, pay your bills, right?
But that's the thing. Some people aren't even okay. Say minimum wage, for example. If you figure that out, you only make $15,000 a year before taxes. I don't know what a living wage should be considered, but that seems pretty low. And I looked at several websites today that said that over half of Walmart employees are on some sort of government assistance, whether it be Medicaid or...
I don't know where you read that. I've never seen that. All I know is that when I was a kid and I had a job as a paper boy, which didn't really pay a lot, when I had a job as a dishwasher and when I was cooking, and I was in grade school and then in high school, and tending bar and doing all those jobs, those weren't career jobs for me. Those were jobs that I had that I could put a little bit of money in my pocket and save a little money for college. And that's what I'd use them for.
But some people do have that as just the way, right, their sole way to provide for their families.
Okay, but if you're going to work at McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's or White Castle or any of these other places, Walmart, Kmart, Target, unless you're on a management career trajectory, I don't think most people are expecting that they're going to make a whole lot of money going into those professions.
Well, I'm not saying anyone thinks they're going to get rich in one of those jobs.
No, but I mean,
at least be able to get by.
Well, when I had my jobs and I was making $2 an hour washing dishes or $2.25 an hour washing dishes, I was happy. I had money in my pocket. I was a kid. Now, everybody makes decisions in your life. You act like all of a sudden that this was made, you know, these decisions are made in a vacuum. The single best thing we could do is fix the economy. If we started drilling and we started pursuing natural gas in America, we'd create literally hundreds of thousands of high-paying jobs, but this government is resistant to doing it. And we'd have the benefit of being energy self-sufficient and not dependent on foreign oil. So there are ways to
help these people that we're talking about that don't make enough money to
support their families,
though.
But the people that work in Walmart in North Dakota, where they have a big oil boom going on because they're drilling on private lands, trainees are getting $17 an hour. So I'm saying that the government, because of bad policies and redistributive policies, has now created a bad economy, and all this stimulus spending and all this debt has not helped any business invest in future growth. So all that money's sitting there on the sidelines because people are afraid to invest it. And the government is, in large part, I would argue, responsible for that. Now, I'm just saying this. If you don't want to work at Walmart for your entire life or career, then you've got to make decisions earlier in your life that are going to ensure that your opportunities are going to be greater. Now, what do you do to ensure that you have greater opportunity in life? You develop either a marketable skill. Let's say if you want to become a mechanic, you know what it's like? I had to put some windshield washer in my car this weekend. Did you ever open up a Escalade, what do you call it? I have an Escalade hybrid. You ever open that up?
No, I've never been in an Escalade.
I used to be able to change my brakes on my car, do tune-ups. I used to be able to, you know, change starters and alternators. And, you know, these are all jobs I did myself when I had cheap cars when I was growing up. I could not tell you anything about that car today. I would not be able to do a thing without screwing it up because of the electronics that are now involved in mechanical devices like an automobile. So if you're a mechanic, I know a mechanic's making $40-$50 an hour. That if you went through the effort of going to school, learning how to be a mechanic, and getting trained into being a mechanic, you're going to make a much better living than somebody that works at Walmart, right?
Yes.
Okay, if you make the effort to be a carpenter's apprentice, which, by the way, I was once in my life, and you go through the effort, you become a junior apprentice, then you become, you know, you move work your way up until you're a full-time carpenter, and then you can build a house, and you can build somebody a deck, and you don't need any help, then you're going to make more money because you have more skills, right?
Yes.
If you go to nursing school, you're going to be better off even still, right? And if you go to Wharton School of Business, you're probably going to come out of Wharton School of Business and you're going to do pretty well.
Except for
what?
Most people that are graduating college right now can't find jobs that are comparable to their degree and their...
Well, that's in part because of the Obama economy. He's had 4 years and things are worse, not better, than when he started. You're right. Obama's hurt the economy. His policies have failed. But that doesn't stop people from making good decisions in their life.
I'm currently in college.
What are you studying?
Environmental science.
Environmental science. It's probably because of the left-wing environmental nutcases. It's probably going to be a big growth area. You know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad decision. But I think environmental science, I'm not sure what an environmental scientist does, but so you're probably against drilling.
I'm not completely against drilling. I just think we need to ensure that it is safe.
It is safe.
Before we get too overly invested in it.
It is safe. It is safe.
There's some conflicting on that.
No, because we drill literally billions of gallons of oil a day, and there's very few incidents that we can point to. And then we have new technology that helps us clean up if, God forbid, there's a disaster.
But I think accountability is part of that. If there is no accountability, then no one is going to care if it's safe or not.
Remember the deep water horizon well out in the Gulf? Maybe if environmentalists didn't push oil companies so far out into the deep water, if they could drill in shallower water, we would have had a greater ability to cap that well when they had a problem. Good point, Mr. Hannity.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't think I can agree with that. Because
it makes too much sense.
Nobody wants anything right off the shore. Nobody even wants a windmill right off the shore.
Well, so certainly the Kennedys.
I don't think you can blame environmentalists for not being able to drill right off the shore.
I'm saying in shallow waters. You could be a mile out, you won't see a thing.
And I don't know the specific regulation against that.
Well, there is. Why do you think they were going down an entire mile into the ocean floor? Because you think it was convenient? No, because that's where the government would allow the drilling. Now, let me give you another example. We can drill in Anwar. There's nothing there. I've shown video on TV of Anwar. It was acquired by Jimmy Carter for the very purpose that we could be drilling there. But when the only thing stopping us are environmentalists and left-wingers. Why wouldn't we drill in a wilderness? Prudhoe Bay ended up giving us 10 times the amount of oil that they wanted. They were worried about the caribou up there. The caribou ended up loving the pipeline, because it kept them warm in the winter.
It also divided their population.
No, it didn't. Because the herds grew like fivefold in the process. I wrote about it in my first book.
Wilderness areas, that's Anwar's one thing to be debated. No. I will give you that. But I am a proponent of protecting wilderness areas.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you drive around on your bicycle and you be a good role model? If you need to go to California, you can take the train or take a bus. And I think you should live according to the lifestyle that you aspire us to go to. You lead by example.
That.
In other words, Learjet, limousine, liberal Leonardo DiCaprio, maybe next New Year's Eve, ought not be flying to Australia, to Vegas, to celebrate New Year's in two different time zones.
Oh, I would agree with that. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, there's a lot of Hollywood hypocrites out there. They talk about the environment, lecture us about our SUVs, yet they fly around in their little private jets.
I would not argue that there's no hypocrisy out there.
Yeah. In that case, I think it was like a 747 that they chartered. Isn't that nice?
I wouldn't argue the fact that there's...
And Al Gore, I got a picture of him getting off a Gulfstream 2, which is like the oldest model and one of the least energy efficient in the sky. Can you imagine Al Gore getting off, just like him selling to Al Jazeera, Qatar, an oil-rich oil-rich country? Pretty hypocritical, right?
Yeah, I saw his defense of that. I can't say I was
impressed. Let me ask this question. Don't you think it's dumb... Here we are, a society that still needs energy, natural gas. We need gasoline. We need oil. How about this? Don't you think it's pretty dumb that we pay premium prices by lowering the supply and having to buy from countries that hate us? Isn't that stupid?
I think it's also
it's dumb.
Stupid that we export oil and then import oil from other countries.
Yeah, I think that's dumb, too. But isn't it dumb that we literally buy our oil and we have more oil here with the Saudi Arabia of natural gas and we don't tap into our own resources? Isn't that dumb?
I think it's a necessary.
It's dumb. Why don't you just say it? It's dumb. It won't hurt you. Say it. It's dumb.
But I think it needs to be done carefully. Okay. It's dumb not to invest in that to some extent. I also think...
Well, the Saudis are doing it pretty well. They seem to be doing pretty well extracting all that oil, don't they?
I guess that could be debated as well.
I mean, the bottom line is, while you and your liberal friends, your environmental studies pals, are developing new technology, maybe you ought to go to the Kennedys and ask them why they're hypocritical and they didn't want to put those windmills outside of their compound in Nantucket. That was pretty hypocritical, right?
Like I said, I won't debate that hypocrisy exists.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's pretty interesting when you put it all together. I bet they don't talk about this in your class, do they?
We actually do have some pretty lively discussions.
I think I ought to come. What school do you go to?
It's actually called American Public University.
Yeah, they should invite me and debate your environmental studies teacher, and I'll debate the lack of real science on global warming.
I'm not sure who I could contact to make that happen, but let me look into that.
But you guys you'll have to hire a private jet to get me there. How's that?
I don't know. It's pretty.
I'm only kidding.
I don't think it'd be in the budget.
I didn't think so. All right, got to run, Pam. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Let us say hi to Joe in Dallas. What's up, Joe? How are you?
Good, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm good, buddy. What's going on?
Oh, you know, I was just going to make a comment on the little Rubio Watergate scandal. I know, obviously, it wasn't the forum for it, but it would have been great if he had reached off the podium and grabbed a 64-ounce Coke and taken a big sip and said, "Cheers, here to you, here's to you, Chuck Schumer." And
should have
Bloomberg.
Said it to Mayor Bloomberg, the nanny.
Yeah, Bloomberg.
That would have been funny. I agree. That's a pretty good idea.
Too bad it wasn't the forum for it.
Thanks, Joe. Good point. That's funny. Sydney is in Orlando. News Talk, WDBO. What's up, Sydney? How are you?
Well, I just was a little upset when I hear stuff about the military. My son is in the U.S. Navy, and I find it appalling that our commander-in-chief does not even have to have served in a day in the military, and he's making decisions about my son. I have a problem with that.
Well, he was elected, commander-in-chief. It's part of his role. I kind of am very frustrated. I don't think this president knows what's happening in terms of world events. And certainly the United States has pulled back. And when we pull out, that vacuum's filled by people that usually don't have other people's best intentions.
I agree. But they're making decisions about thousands of people, their very lives and their welfare. And yet they have no clue what they're talking about.
No, pretty much none. You're right. They are.
And even our Secretary of Navy and so on doesn't have to have served. I don't get that. They're supposed to be advisors to the president.
Listen, I would just say anybody that wants to serve in the military, you've got to look very closely at the people that are in charge that you'll have to say yes, sir, no, sir, to. Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, to. And I would just say, make your decision accordingly. If you think that you agree philosophically that they will make the good, wise decisions, then you feel free to go into the military. But I got to be honest, the military that's going to cut it to almost a level that is scary and we're going to have a vulnerability for the country, that puts everybody in jeopardy. I don't like it.
Exactly. That's what scares me. I mean,
it
he's making cuts that he has no clue what he's doing.
I would agree with that, too. And I think he's got people in there that, frankly, are not fit for those jobs.
Exactly. But why isn't it mandatory that at least the Secretary of Navy and Air Force and so on have to have served in that branch? I don't get why it's not.
Well, I think good people can serve from a civilian background. But I just think you've got to get the right people with the right understanding of world events. And I don't think we have that today. But I got to roll.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for a good call. All right, that's going to wrap things up for today. We will be on Hannity tonight, 9 Eastern, on the Fox News Channel. The Obamas take, separate vacations, and you pay for it all. 9 Eastern. Also, the latest on Alec Baldwin's meltdown, I guess the latest way to put it. The Benghazi definitive report and crossing the line on Saturday Night Live. 9 Eastern, Hannity, set your DVR on the Fox News Channel. Back here tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. Happy President's Day.